Book 2, Chapter 8. While the elite of the interdependency were making their plans to abandon the common people to their fate, the common people of the interdependency were beginning to come to grips with what exactly that fate actually was. It should be noted that common people of the interdependency were not fools. They were, arguably, the most educated and materially comfortable common people ever to live in any human civilization, going back to when the first human decided hoofing themselves across the African landscape was a pain in the ass and decided to stay in one place instead. The population of the interdependency were not fools largely for two reasons. The first was that the vast majority of the interdependency's billions of souls lived their lives either in cities hollowed out from the ground of otherwise uninhabitable planets or inside habitats floating in space. In either of these environments, a large population of the uneducated and feral would be a clear and present safety issue for everyone else. The second reason was that the ruling class of the interdependency, favoring financial and social stability over having the lumpen proletariat trying to rip their heads from their necks at every opportunity, opted to have the interdependency's baseline standard of living one where no one starved, or was without shelter, or died of easily preventable diseases, or went bankrupt if they had a heart attack or lost a job, or both. For these reasons, the interdependency held no poor, or rabble, in ways that elites of previous civilizations would understand the term. This was great if your goal was keeping a large population of humans spread across trillions of kilometers of physical space reasonably content on a day-to-day basis. It was less great if your goal was to, say, leave these billions completely in the dark about the encroaching end of civilization that was likely to end in slow famine and death for each of them if nothing was done. They knew. They knew because the scientists analyzing the data that Jamies and Mars Claremont and Hatid Roynald had collected had come largely from the middle and working classes of the interdependency, and they shared information and data. They knew because the crews of the ships that plied the flow, who had pledged themselves to the guilds that the noble families controlled, were also from the middle and working classes. They knew because the journalists of the interdependency were from these classes as well. And they knew because the Emperor Greyland II, who lived her early life as the child of an academic, had in her wisdom or naivete, or both, decided to let the truth about the imminent collapse of the flow go out to the public. They knew, and they knew reasonably early in the grand scheme of things. But what did they do with that information? A large number of people looked at when their particular system would be entirely cut off from the rest of the interdependency, decided that it was enough time in the future that someone would probably figure out what to do, and then went back to their daily lives, only mildly more apprehensive than before. The more ambitious planned protests and conferences and composed strongly worded missives to their local system and interdependency ministers of parliament, saying in no uncertain terms that something should be done, that that's what they were elected for. Then they, too, mostly went back to their lives under the impression that they, at least, had done something. Another group, which might charitably be called entrepreneurs or, less charitably, grifters, saw in the end of the world a business opportunity and began to target the particularly fearful, anxious, and inconsolable. That went as it usually does. A rather smaller group of people looked at the flow streams that were still open, saw how long it would be before it would be impossible to catch a ship to and from where they were, and started making plans to catch those ships at or near the last possible instant, saving up all the while. This crafty bit of foresight was undercut by the fact these people generally did not, in fact, make their reservations paid in full the second they thought of it. It meant that when they did get around to it, they would discover that every passenger berth had been reserved years in advance and at exorbitant rates. After all, these days, when a ship went to end, it stayed at end forever. These people had already missed their chance to escape, and they didn't even know it. They likely couldn't have afforded it anyway. At the local and system levels, governments and their related organizations, populated from the non-noble classes, were beginning to form committees and study groups on the impact of the impending flow collapse and what those would mean to their habitats and cities. Of considerable and particular concern was what would happen to the commodities for which a non-local noble house held monopoly. To give one less critical example, take citrus fruits, whose monopoly was held by the House of Lagos. In every system, local franchisees grew and sold the fruits, taking their cut of the profits and sending the rest back to Lagos's coffers. In the event that a franchisee decided not to send along a cut, or was just so bad at their job that they never made a profit, all the Lagos fruit stock was genetically encoded to stop producing after a certain number of generations, the number of generations predetermined before the stock was delivered. If the franchisee doesn't pay up, their stock becomes useless. Seeds the fruit produce are sterile. Grafting or cloning won't work. If you think you're going to just easily reverse engineer the stock, well, you can try, and good luck. Just remember that the House of Lagos has been genetically designing and tweaking its stock for literally centuries, with a specific eye on maintaining its monopoly. Re-engineering so much as a lemon from scratch would likely take decades. Now, multiply that problem against everything humans eat, anywhere, including the staples. That's the problem. It was less of a problem when the goal was to tie all known human systems into a web of mutual reliance, ostensibly to lessen the threat of interstellar war and trade conflict, but mostly so that a small number of mercantile families could rent-seek from the rest of humanity in perpetuity. But now that all those systems were about to be on their own, possibly forever, it became a very large, very looming issue. Local and system governments had begun to make overtures to the representatives of the mercantile houses about these monopolies. The general response from the houses was, "Oh, we're looking at this, but we have years to work on this problem, so let's not do anything foolish." Which is to say, the monopolists stalled to their own benefit. The local and system governments, not wanting to start panics before they had to, said nothing outside their own committees and organizations. But again, it's not like the common people didn't know. Some of them, the more ambitious ones, if you'd like to call them that, had already started working the futures markets, placing down markers for the cost of lemons and wheat and beef and every other commodity under the various suns. Others, equally ambitious, figured that the monopolies of the noble families would be broken and shorted these commodities. Some of these people would become immensely rich, to the extent that money would continue to mean anything in the end times, while others would likely find their way to a convenient airlock to end their own self-inflicted suffering. They differed in their opinion as to which would be which. Capitalism was like that. Most others who were thinking ahead at all simply planned to stockpile certain foods. How much? A month, 6 months, a year, depending on available space and personal pessimism. Most of those thinking about stockpiling still had in their brains the idea that the crisis was likely to be a temporary one, and that somewhere along the way, someone would figure out how to keep billions from starving to death in the habitats that would increasingly fall to entropy. To think otherwise would raise the questions of why bother to stockpile at all. Of course, if one wanted to genuinely understand what the over-underline for "we're all genuinely and truly fucked" was, one ought not look at what the lower classes of the interdependency were doing, but rather what their banks were doing. And what the banks were doing, as quietly as possible and without raising too much of a fuss about it, was restructuring their financial services and vehicles to maximize short-term profits and minimize long-term financial risk and exposure, which on one hand was entirely prudent from a fiscal and fiduciary point of view. The interdependency was about to enter a new and entirely unexpected period of change. Banks are inherently conservative entities. It's right there in their name. And so it made good sense to bulk up against uncertainty. On the other hand, it meant that the money had cast its vote on the future, and the vote was to short it. Then there was the matter of the banks beginning to transfer assets to END, which they also did not make a fuss about. There was no reason to, since END was covered by the same financial laws and strictures as the rest of the interdependency. And money was such an abstruse concept anyway. Does it really matter where you say these assets are? But which was also a vote in itself. Most of this bank activity, as intended, went under the radar of the average person. The average person might have appreciated the slightly higher interest rates on their savings accounts, intended to keep them from withdrawing their funds in the short term. And those with long-term notes with banks might have been tempted to take up the offer to refinance to a shorter-term loan, with certain fees waived and interest rates competitive to the longer-term loans. Otherwise, it was business as usual. It did the banks no good to create a panic. They wanted to be sure that when the panic inevitably hit, the majority of their assets would be as far away as possible. The people in their governments would have more immediate things to worry about than the banks returning a fraction of people's accounts, if that, when all the shit finally came crashing down. But what of the Parliament of the Interdependency, the august body that Emperor Greyland II had given 6 months to offer up a plan to deal with the collapse of the flow? What was going down in the House of the People's Representatives? It would be unfair to suggest, as Nadashe Nohama-Peton and Greyland's analysts had both done, that Parliament was merely frittering away on the problem until such time as Greyland took it from them, and then it would be her problem to solve, not theirs. Parliament had, in fact, assembled its best ministers and advisors together to ascertain the scope of the issue and to make suggestions for the Parliament at large to act on. The problem for Parliament's Extraordinary Committee on the Flow Crisis, as it called itself, was that it had come to the same conclusion as everyone else looking at the problem. The vast majority of the people who live in the interdependency were impressively screwed, and there was no easy or comfortable course of action in front of them. The question then became, what percentage was there in the Parliament being the bearer of that sort of bad news? It was not merely an academic question. A not trivial number of parliamentarians had thrown themselves in with the recent coup attempt against the Emperor, which had gone poorly for them and everyone else involved. As a result, the reputation and popularity of the Parliament was at its lowest point in decades, and in perhaps more than a century. This was saying something, as Parliament was almost never popular and was almost always used as a convenient target of ire for local and system governments and their representatives, who were closer to their voting populations and who were always looking for someone else to blame for local problems. These local and system governments and representatives, not to mention the noble houses and mercantile guilds, would be delighted to have the Interdependency Parliament be the focus of their constituents' and stakeholders' ire. It wouldn't be so bad for the Emperor, either. The young Emperor had become a favorite of her subjects for having survived 2 assassination attempts and a coup, and for claiming the religious mantle of the Emperor in a way that none of her predecessors had since the days of Raikela I, the founder of the Interdependency. Any further denigration of the Parliament worked to her advantage. That being the case, the Extraordinary Committee, with no plan that didn't end in the slow death of billions and no easy way to sell that outcome, was coming to the conclusion that its best course of action was to delay, take the relatively small hit for indecision, and let the Emperor take the rather larger hit for being the bearer of the impressively bad news. Greyland had popularity to burn. Let her burn all of it. In the meantime, the members of the Extraordinary Committee would book the rides to end that their constituents assumed would be available to them a few years into the future. Oh yes, end. The one exception to the doom that awaits every other system of the interdependency. The one system with a planet where humans could walk upon its surface without a suit of one sort or another, where the land would welcome them instead of turn them into desiccated husks, where the sun would warm their unprotected faces instead of blasting them with unmediated radiation scrambling DNA, the one place where humanity could still survive. Well, except for the fact that the people of End were aware of what was coming for them. A sudden and overwhelming wave of refugees from the rest of the interdependency whose sheer numbers would outstrip the planet's ability to absorb them. The question was not whether they would come. They were coming. They were already on their way. The question was how many. Whether it would be millions, which would strain the planet, or billions, which would destroy it. And hey, there was that whole Civil War thing going on, which made it difficult for anyone to prepare. It did, however, make it easier for some to do other things. The Civil War was largely focused on the major cities and some strategic transport hubs and routes. In outlying provinces, enterprising farmers were claiming lands they didn't technically own and preparing them for crops and ranching. This was every bit of the ecological nightmare that one might expect. But inasmuch as the acting Duke of End was busy not having his head delivered to Vrenna Claremont, no one was stopping them. And anyway, the farmers and ranchers rationalized it by noting that they were planning and raising the few native crops and animals that could be eaten by humans, which is to say, the only foodstuffs that had not been genetically engineered to sustain a monopoly. These farmers and ranchers weren't wrong about that, which did not actually mitigate either the land grab or the pall of the sky as thousands of square kilometers burned away End's ecosystems in exchange for acreage that would not come close to feeding and sustaining the millions to billions who would be on their way. Which was pointed out to some of these ambitious farmers and ranchers, who said, basically, "Sure, but it'll be years yet. Someone will figure this out, and when they do, I'll be rich." And thus, it was in the interdependency, in the early but not all that early anymore days of the flow collapse. Everyone knew what was coming. Some even prepared and planned. But at the end of it, everyone assumed that something or someone would come along to save the civilization that they lived in and could not conceive of actually disappearing. Something or someone would come along to save them. They would be saved along with everyone else. It was a nice thought. It wasn't true. At the very least, not yet.